I don't know who the fuck loses their job when they put chicken sauce nuggets in the bag at McDonald's, but if you are one of those people, we need to get it together as one. I don't care who's becoming president. I don't care who the chamber, who the cabinet is. I don't care about anything. We as Americans need to fight back against not receiving our nugget sauce at McDonald's.
Man.
I was told that if I wanted to check my order last night, that I needed to pull forward. She was 16, but I told her to go fuck herself. So her dad's probably looking for me, honestly. Yeah.
Like, I'll fucking sit right here and check it. If you didn't fuck it up, you have nothing to worry about.
And she's like, it's all there. I said, give me my fucking barbecue sauce. Two of them. He said, I'm going to give you three.
Hell yeah.
I said, this stuff doesn't happen at Chick-fil-A.
Hell no.
It doesn't happen at Chick-fil-A. God. People are probably like, well, you don't need to be eating McDonald's, you fat shit.
That's true.
Thanks, Rob.
I mean, nobody does. Not just you.
No, it's me. I felt directed. I felt calculated and directed. I understand what you're saying. This is the fork in the road. It's been a lot of years that there was going to be a time sooner or later where you and I just like couldn't fucking be friends anymore. And just,
McDonald's is just
it's what come between us.
It's the Walmart of fast food places.
That's why they're inside Walmarts.
There you exactly.
A lot of Subways now.
That's true.
But one
they're
half,
just as bad though.
Hey,
Subway.
Yeah, I fucking hate Subway.
Yeah, it's awful.
Like it. I'm one half of the Brohio podcast, the delicious Nickalicious.
And I am the other half. What's going on, guys? I'm Rob Dog. Hey.
We're coming off a big weekend of a Zoom live show where we had friends from all over the world join us.
Yeah, it was a great time.
We did Rob did this wild video game theory about the government killing us and stealing our bodies.
Polybius.
And then I did a exorcism mystery paranormal event about Dick Decker, Don Decker, whatever his name was.
Big Dick Decker.
Dirty Dick Don Decker.
Dirty Dick, that's what he had.
Then we performed a self-written murder mystery where the listeners had to guess who the murderer was.
And once again, good job on that.
Right. Oh, thank you.
No, that's you.
It's McDonald's. But you're making fun of my McDonald's again.
Nope.
And then we ate some really hot shit. And I would like to say, Rob, I still haven't had any milk. We did a death nut challenge.
You did really well.
I went through all five nuts. I didn't have any milk. I was bleeding out of my face. I was snotting, sweating. Then Rob had a little nitro, like a death gummy bear. And I forgot he even took it.
Yeah, I went through four, and then I almost got sick because I drank way too much fucking milk. So I had to give myself some time, and they wanted me to do the gummy bear, so I did the gummy bear.
Turns out, if you drink, like...
And it wasn't the type of gummy bears I'm used to taking.
No. If you eat a gallon of... If you drink a gallon of milk...
Half gallon.
It's likely to...
Don't church it up.
It's likely to kill you.
Oh, man, it was rough.
Ooh-wee. We have this episode this week. Usually when we're coming off something big like a live show or a Zoom live event, then the next episode gets really half-assed. That was not the case this week. This is a lot into this one.
I thought you were going to say, and you know, this week is just the same.
You guys shouldn't be surprised.
No, this is a good one. It's got a lot of audio content to go with it from the person, the main character of the story. So
hell yeah.
A lot of good stuff going on with it. All right, first off, let's thank our new Patreon subscribers. If you are one of them, thank you. And let's go with first, Amy T, as in Amy Tit. No, her last name wasn't on there. So, Amy, thank you for your Patreon pledge.
Dean M, what in my butt? Dean Watts, thank you, sir.
Watts, yes. Misty Starkey, Sharky Starkey. You know, we grew up in a really small town just north of Dayton called Northridge. And they have a strip called North Dixie, and they say it's the home of used cars and titty bars.
That's true.
Well, God had enough of that shit about a year and a half ago, and he fucking leveled the whole entire township
tornadoed
with a tornado.
Down.
We call it the Memorial Day Tornadoes. Took a lot of strip clubs and used car lots with it, but there was one specific joint on the strip called Sharky's.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing about Sharky's is the front of, I only went in there once and it was not on purpose. And this is right when I turned 18. It was a really bad experience, really poor experience. They got a lot of crackheads working in there, Rob.
Sure.
But the best thing about Sharky's is it was right by the road. So when I was a kid, we could ride past it and there was a shark tank in the front. There was a big fucking shark And the shark had panties in his mouth.
Yep.
It was like a stuffed shark.
Hanging from the teeth, yeah.
Yeah, there was panties hanging from his mouth. And every time we'd drive past it, I'd pull my little weenus out and I'd start trying to get it off. It never worked.
Fuck the shark?
Yeah. That's right. And then I said, when I get big enough, I'm going to ride my bike up here and take those panties. I never did that.
But,
you know, it's...
Those things are probably rancid.
The stories those panties could tell. That was a disgusting place.
Oh, shit. And last but not least, Jared Foley. Thank you, Foley.
If you would like to have your name pleasured on the beginning of this episode, go to patreon.com/BrohioPodcast.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Where you guys can... Yeah, it's like... Speaking of gifts that keep on giving, there's going to be one of those in this episode as well.
Sweet.
All right, let's talk about our funny newspaper article of the week that just came through about 30 seconds ago when Hell Rob yeah. was walking through the door.
All right, I'm ready.
Well, before we go to that, how did your asshole transition the next day after eating on the hot nuts?
I did not have a single problem.
I had many, many problems.
Yeah.
My wife went and got me baby wipes that I was having so many, 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 many problems.
Well, I didn't have any spicy shits, I should say. My asshole exploded right when I walked through the door, but besides that...
That guy was too quick. Unless your digestive tract is like a straight 12-inch shot, like a...
Yeah.
You know, straight down, there's no way it could have been through that.
I think mine was just from all the milk. Fucking half gallon, man.
Yeah, man.
I mean, I was sipping it. I mean, I wasn't like chugging it or anything, but still, I went through three glasses.
My fucking butt was fucked up for sure.
Yeah, you went in dry.
It was a bad addition. Bad addition. You can tell I'm not a...
You didn't even lube up at all.
I'm a foreign lover. I don't know how to do this stuff anymore. 7 people have died from drinking hand sanitizer after the party they were at ran out of alcohol, according to reports out of Russia.
Fucking Russia, of course.
Oh, Russia. It's understood some 9 people began drinking the antiseptic wash, which is 69% methanol.
Oh, okay. Man, that'll fuck you up right there.
2 men aged 27 and 59, as well as a 41-year-old woman, were the first to die.
Wait, these fuckers were this old? I wasn't going to expect them to be like 16, 17.
When we get... out of the alcohol, then we get out the real stuff. 6 others were urgently flown by a medical evacuation aircraft to a hospital in the city of Yakutsk. Sadly, another 4 did not survive, while 2 are currently fighting for life in hospital. The poisoning took place as a result of drinking sanitizer, the regional state prosecutor said. Authorities in Russia are again pleading with locals to refrain from drinking the hand sanitizer. I tell you that I hear this from American Fox News. Donald Trump says you drink, inject bleach. You drink and hand sanitizer and kill coronavirus.
Yeah, there's no way there's a shortage of cheap vodka in Russia.
Just think, if we drink much methanol, then we can fight a fucking bear. We wrestle bear.
Works for Khabib.
I saw a video the other day of a Russian. I thought that was all made up. The guy was legit wrestling a bear.
No, I literally
from
just
Russia.
I literally just saw a picture a couple minutes ago of Khabib when he was a little boy and he had a bear in a headlock.
That's a bad motherfucker, dude.
Yes, it is.
I mean, that I'm talking about that bear for even getting in the ring with Khabib.
Exactly.
You know, a lot of people aren't huge UFC fans that listen to us, but there are a lot that are. Rob's the biggest.
Yeah.
I'm about in the middle.
Only sport I follow.
But Khabib, man, that's a dude to watch. He's
bad motherfucker.
I hate him, but ever since he jumped the cage and tried to fight the entire crowd after the Conor
fight. Yeah, it soured a lot of people.
Yeah, but.
There's talks, man. His last fight, he said he was retiring, but supposedly he's talking it over with his family, and they're trying to make him and GSP his last fight.
Yeah, that's what his dad wanted.
Maybe his dad wanted him. His dad wanted him to go 30-0. But his mom wanted him to quit after 29. Since his dad passed away, he told his mom he would never do another one.
That's what a guy.
Man.
Speaking of heartache and despair.
Oh, yeah.
Joe Burrow passed away yesterday. Well, his
Pretty
leg
much.
Passed away.
Yeah.
And as a huge Bengals fan, you know what that means.
He's such an awesome guy, though.
He is, dude.
It's a bummer to see that this organization, after years and years, hasn't learned from their mistakes that they need to protect their fucking quarterbacks.
I don't even fucking know anymore. Mike Brown, if you're listening on your fucking AM radio right now, he's the owner of the Bengals.
He's like 145.
He looks like Humpty Dumpty with erectile dysfunction is what that guy looks like. Fuck you, pal.
Get a fucking line.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, well, we're going to go ahead and hop into this one because this is going to be a long one. Maybe not a long one, but there's a lot of content here. There's a lot of multimedia stuff to go along with it.
Hell yeah.
Perhaps. I hope that you guys are completely ready for the List Family Murders.
Sweet.
I think that we're going to class. This is the cleanest mass murder that's ever taken place in the history of fucking America.
Okay.
That, in my opinion, this is a good one. So think about the picturesque life in your mind, what that would be like. A beautiful, albeit mostly drunk wife.
Yeah, buddy.
A stepdaughter.
Yeah, buddy.
And a few kids of your own.
Okay.
Oh, man. Okay. It gets so much better. You're brilliant with a knack for crunching numbers, and you've been fast-tracking your career because how well you do with cooking the books. How well you do with the books. You're making money hand over fist, unlike Rob Dog and I. What is there not to love about your life? For John List, yeah, John List, like, you know, List as in like the It List podcast.
Sure.
They're a brother podcast. Go check them out, the It List podcast. But John List, he had it all. He was a decorated military man that was finding his way in the civilian world quite easily. John List was born in Bay City, Michigan, and he was an only child to German-American strict-ass fucking dickhead parents. He said he was pretty close to his mom, but he said his dad was a fucking dictator.
Yeah, and judging from the year he was born, their parents were born in the fucking 1800s, so...
yeah, you know, he was...
It was different times.
for sure, different times. But he said his dad was an asshole, like just a loveless fucking prick.
Yeah.
He grew up in a very devout Lutheran home. Is Lutheran, is that Catholic?
No, that's Christian.
Is it?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure.
Pretty sure.
I honestly didn't know.
I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure.
Somebody
will correct me here on YouTube.
What is Lutheran? It is one of the most Protestant?
Protestant.
Okay. I don't know.
Christianity, I think.
Yeah, sure. Whatever. Luther. Martin Luther King. He was a hell of a fucking guy. I'm all down for Lutheran, and I like Martin Luther. So he had these strict-ass parents. His father was a Sunday school teacher, and he would also follow in his footsteps. And John List, he would become a Sunday school teacher as well when he would get older. John was born in 1925. Yes, he's the subject of this episode. He was born in 1925, so he was entering adulthood right at the time of World War II. Talk about a fucking hitting the lottery on that one, buddy.
Ouch.
Much like other men at this time, he enlisted in the U.S. Army to serve his country during the World War. He served as a lab technician, so he didn't overdo it. He said, I'm not getting my fucking wiener blown to smithereens. I'm going to be a lab technician.
Hell yeah.
He was discharged in 1946. He went on to secure his master's degree in accounting from the University of Michigan.
Oh, heck yeah.
And guys with... master degrees in accounting, they only fuck missionary style. That's one of the prerequisites as far as graduating with a master's in accounting is you may only penetrate your significant other, whether male or female, missionary style.
And they all kiss with their eyes open.
They do kiss with their eyes open. No tongue style like I do with my wife and Rob's mother-in-law, but we like to entertain the thought of, you know what, look, you know what's, I think about the human anatomy for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Man, missionary style works for man and woman, but man and man, that's a hard one to pull off. Someone, a country blumpkin like me, that's kind of roly-poly, be hard to get my butt tilted up in the air. I'm heavy and all. I'm not just heavy. Some people are top heavy. I'm all the way heavy, like all the way around. Old body's heavy. There's no light part of my body. Like you could cut my finger off and use it to hold down paper in like a windstorm.
Just the thought of two guys fucking missionary is so funny. There's one getting his asshole fucked out while his little dick's just flopping around there.
That's another hard one. Guys in the pornographies that can keep an erection during gay sex, more power to you guys, because that would be a hard one to do.
I mean, the money they make, huh? Fuck, it may keep my dick hard.
They probably... money makes my dick hard.
There you go.
Yeah, he was commissioned as a second lieutenant through the ROTC program at the University of Michigan.
Yeah.
And once he was done with college, which he probably didn't pay a fucking penny for, because that's the way that works. When he was done with college, he went back into the military for the Korean War. It's double whammy. He got a little taste of the World War, and then he got a little taste of the Korean War. Both
couldn't get enough.
both incredibly nasty wars
that
a lot of people died in. He was stationed in Fort Eustis, Virginia. I think that's how you pronounce that. Yeah. Eustis, where he would actually meet the woman he would eventually marry.
Aww.
Her name was Helen Morris Taylor. She had already met and married another man that was not John List. And she had even started a family with this man. When they brought their, they started a family by bringing their daughter Brenda into the world.
Okay.
Unfortunately, her husband was killed in battle in the Korean War. So here she is, kind of a widow at this point. John worked to help pick up the broken pieces. And for 13 months, they dated before actually getting married on December 1st of 1951. Shortly after getting married, the Army Corps realized the brilliant ability that John List had in accounting. Well, he had a goddamn master's degree in accounting, and he only did missionary style. So, yeah, he's good at fucking numbers. So they reassigned him to the Finance Corps in California. How exciting that, exhilarating that must have been just to be in the accounting corps. I'm sure those parties were just absolutely wild. Something like you'd see at a Wolf of Wall Street. Those
hell yeah, that'd be sweet.
Accounting parties.
Oh, yeah. Cocaine everywhere.
Well,
do they have cocaine back in there?
No, this guy doesn't even know what. Yeah, he is the definition of cocaine. He's so white.
There you go.
Shortly after getting married, I'm sorry, I already read that part. He completed his second tour of duty in 1952 and moved to Detroit, Michigan. Oh, the motor fucking city, where he and his wife Helen would have three children together.
I'm admiring all the fucking yeast at the bottom of this bottle.
Yeah, that was very yeast. That was a yeast infection for sure.
Fuck it.
Beer has a yeast infection.
Can't wait to bite into it.
Give me that yeast, baby.
Yeah, so he's moving to Detroit, Michigan, of all places. You know, he's originally from, I think it's Bay City, Michigan. I could be wrong about that. But they had their... He had his stepdaughter, Brenda, and they went on to have three more children. I believe Fred, John Jr., and Patricia were the name of his three additional children. As the years passed, John would switch jobs several times. And I wrote here that it wasn't due to being fired, that he was just being offered better positions. But as further I got into the research, I discovered that, yes, he was getting fired from all these different jobs. But he had such a good resume and such a strong things backing his career that he was getting even better jobs even every time he got fired. So
hell yeah, man. Good for him.
He'd get fired and he'd go to the next place like, look, I'm applying for CEO. And they'd be like, you got it, dude. But then all these places were like, this guy's fucking retarded. And they would fire him. And there was this big write-up from this author that said that John List probably, for lack of a better word, was probably on the autism spectrum, and then he had a hard time socializing and he had a hard time adjusting socially, and he couldn't quite make friends, and okay, he didn't know how to act around people.
It's very common with those.
Yeah. Now, he was moving the entire family around a lot because he was getting all these different jobs and going to all these different places. He's going to Kalamazoo, wherever that's at. They probably got fantastic kangaroo salad there. He went to Rochester, New York, and eventually he settled in New Jersey.
Jersey,
like our friend Jersey Pete. But he was getting paid at all these fucking jobs. It wasn't like the family was suffering. And after a brief stint at Xerox as director of accounting services, he would move the family permanently to Jersey City, New Jersey, but not before some family issues started to rear their head. And I just want to set the table right now of how deeply devout and entrenched this man was in his religion. His entire life revolved around serving God and doing exactly what God desired. There was no other rule besides the Bible for this fucking dude. His kids were taught that that's the way they're supposed to live, and that's exactly how he wanted his family to live. And if they weren't doing exactly what the Word of God asked him to do,
live by the book, die by the book,
then he was getting pretty pissed off. He was not a happy camper, much like his father, who was a devout Lutheran as well, strong followers of Martin Luther King,
a Lutheran.
I don't think that's right at all.
It works.
Okay. So they did start to have some family issues. It was becoming quite apparent that Helen, his wife, was a raging fucking alcoholic. She was a drunk. Rob looked at her picture. He said, "God damn, that bitch has got a lazy eye." And I said, "Rob, you're going to find out why she has a lazy eye, because she was always fucking drunk. But there's another reason."
I want to be that fucking drunk where my one eye just doesn't even work.
It's droopy like an old fucking wiener. Yeah. So he was, I think that he was having a lot of problems with getting her to conform to his religious views.
Okay.
But she was just staying schlobbered all the time. And eventually gets to the point where it was more than.
I mean, that just
alcohol.
That just totally scared me because I didn't see the link up for this.
Yeah, I know.
And I was like, oh shit, are we recording?
Yeah, right, I would have fucking sucked a wiener right now. I got the backup recording, so we'd have been okay.
That's true.
We'd have been just fine. But his stepdaughter, Brenda. So his wife had a daughter when they married.
Okay.
Brenda. She said she'd had enough of this fucking shit. She had enough of how strict John was, and she was tired of her mom always being drunk. So she found a man, and she got married, and she left the house, which is kind of
good.
It was kind of tough on the family handling that. But things, to go back to when John and Helen first got married. So before they even got married, she told him that she was pregnant. Turns out, shortly after the wedding, she confirmed to him that she was not actually pregnant and that he felt like he had been tricked into marrying her because the only reason he jumped into marriage is because he found out that she was pregnant. Shouldn't have been fucking burying that weenie in that peony if you didn't want to fucking, you know. What do they say? Put on some latex so she don't take your paychecks. I hope I never have to pay child support, dude. My buddies at work like, oh, $359 this week. I'm like, Jesus, that one kid? And you're like, yeah, only one kid.
And then my one buddy gets fucking raked over the coals for it. He had to pay like almost $700 a month for one kid. Because he was making a shit ton of money whenever they got a divorce, but then he left that job making as much.
Listen, think there has to be some type of merit system. I'm old school. I think a fucking man should take care of his kids.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
The kind of the new thing, well, we both take care of the kid. Well, that's a completely cool thing as well. But I think for someone just to be like, here's my $500 a paycheck, I take care of my kid. That's not taking care of a kid. Taking care of a kid is showing a kid how to grow up, how to be a fucking socially acceptable human, how to function in the real world. Being a dad isn't just throwing $400 or $500 a week at a kid.
Very true.
And man, I wish everyone was a good parent, man.
The whole system is wrong on every end.
Yeah, I hate seeing kids with shitty parents. That hurts me more than anything, because I may talk like I don't like kids.
Here.
Yeah. Here we are. You know, I think every kid should have a good home. Every kid and every puppy should have a good fucking home.
Especially puppies.
Especially, yeah. Some kids don't deserve it, because I've hung out with some kids before.
Yeah, that some kids suck.
Yeah, they didn't deserve a good home. That's unfortunately how it works. In 1965, he took a position as a vice president and comptroller. I don't know what a comptroller is. At a bank in New Jersey City. In Jersey City, New Jersey. They would move into Breeze Knoll. And that's going to be a word you're going to hear a lot now. Is Breeze Knoll. That was the name of their 19-room Victorian mansion at 431 Hillside Avenue in Westfield. So the fact that he's got his, are you looking up comptroller?
Comptroller in the United States is a high-level executive that oversees the accounting tasks and financial reporting procedures of organizations.
That sounds pretty
fancy. So it's just a fancy word for an accountant.
Yeah,
that's what it sounds like.
It's exactly. But he was vice president of a bank. And So they moved in such a hoity-toity mansion. This thing had a goddamn name. It was called the Breeze Knoll was the name of this
mansion.
That's
so fucking sweet.
There were some conflicting reports on this mansion. Some reports say that they could completely afford this thing with no problem, which I think they probably could have at first, but the fact that they were even able to secure the loan for the mansion says something about, you know, the kind of money he was pulling in. Other reports say that pushy-ass Helen, lazy-eye Helen, wouldn't settle for anything less than the most expensive mansion in the most expensive part of town. So he was kind of bamboozled. At first, she lied to him about being pregnant, so he already felt like he had a misdeed done to him at this point because she lied to him about being pregnant. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, you know, I got to have this fucking flossy-ass mansion, 19-room Victorian. And it doesn't even stop there. There's parts of this house that I'm going to explain a little bit. You're going to be like, God damn, that was an expensive-ass house. But one thing I have left out, apparently. When they move from Michigan to New Jersey, John brought along his mother, Alma. And they had a very close relationship together, he and his mother, Alma. He hated his fucking dad, but he had a really good relationship with his fat-ass mom.
I was not expecting that.
Well, it's all ties in together, Rob. You're going to see it all ties in together. It all makes perfect fucking sense. You're laughing now.
Sure.
But you're not going to be laughing in a little bit, okay?
All right, man.
She even accompanied him to the bank, fat-ass mom did, whenever fat-ass Alma, when he went to get the loan for the Breeze Knoll Mansion. His mother actually did lend him some money to secure the loan for the home. In exchange for the money that she lended him, she got to live in a self-contained apartment that was on the third floor of the Breeze Knoll Mansion. Sounds like your situation, Rob. Oh, I hope this doesn't happen. They assumed this... That's not funny, is it? They assumed this new living situation for the next 6 years. You know, he had three kids in there, his wife... And he's got fat ass Alma stomping around the third floor of the mansion. I can imagine that's like living with a fucking poltergeist and having that fat bitch walking around all the time up there. In those 6 years, though, everything had completely started to go downhill. Now, it was also said that John was seriously abrasive to many of his bosses throughout his career. And I said that before. He lost all his fucking jobs. He didn't know how to act around these people. They're just like, you got a fucking tumor? And he's like, well, let's get a calculator. He just didn't know how to... He just rubbed everybody. He rubbed his coworkers the wrong way. He rubbed his bosses the wrong way. He didn't even know how to rub himself off. That's how fucking miserable of a human he was.
Yeah, and not to mention, I mean, this was back in, like the fucking 50s?
The 60s.
60s, I mean.
Yeah, we're in the 60s now.
Yeah,
mental health,
health wasn't anywhere near like what it is today.
He had an odd way about him, and he oftentimes would get fired or just felt unwanted at his job. So sometimes he would just quit because they made him feel like a fucking dumbass, and he quit. But working as the vice president at this bank was no different than any of the other jobs. He started the clash with many of the people at the bank. He started to get on people's nerves. You got to fucking button down the hatches. You got to fly right, walk straight ahead. You're the vice president of a bank, and you're getting paid fucking cash. You got to just, if I was making that much money, that I was living in a 19-room Victorian mansion.
A manor?
Yeah. Breeze Knoll. Yes, that's where I live. I live in the huge fucking house on the hill. You couldn't shake me. Every day, I would come to work, and they'd be like, "Hey, you know, boss," and I wouldn't be like, living the dream. I'm like, I'm ready to fuck this day. I'm ready to get it on. And people that say, I'm living the dream, they are on the brink of killing themselves.
Oh, yeah.
If you hear someone say that.
I love that line. That's how you know it's true.
That person is really close to.
Their dream is killing themselves.
They are really close to subtracting their self from the earth.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So just keep that in the back of your mind next time someone says that at your work. But the people at the bank, they just couldn't really understand his personality. They'd finally had enough of his shit, so they fired him at the bank. Aww. So he lost this job that provided him this huge mansion, you know. The noble thing to do at this point for him would be to pack up all of his shit at the bank and go home and come clean to his drunk ass housewife and be like, hey, fucking lazy eye Ellen. I fucked up today at work. I fucked up bad. And he got, but he didn't do that. He was afraid to go home and tell his wife what happened. That was not exactly the plan that John had in mind as far as going home and telling her what happened. To me, he seems like he's possibly some type. He's an antisocial. He seems like someone that's probably afraid of confrontation. So he's probably afraid of the confrontation that he would have with his wife. I've been there before. Because like you fucked up. You know, you spent more money than you should have or something, and you need to tell your wife, but you're just scared. You're just like. But I was even the same way when I was a kid, when I would fuck up and I'd be afraid to tell my mom, like, you know, they give me, this was the worst. I fucking hated when my dad did this shit. He would do this all the time too.
Oh man. It's so funny hearing these stories about your parents. Cause like, I know how they are now. Like, I knew them back in the day as well, but like now I know I'm like a lot better.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
This shit fucked me up.
They're like the nicest people in the world.
Not when I was a kid. They're throat cutters, dude. They were different.
My dad beat the fuck out of me with a rake.
My dad never beat
me. With
the
stick of a rake.
Nah, my dad never did that.
In the front yard.
My dad would just fuck me a lot. I'm just kidding. He never did that.
I'm glad he's dead.
Jesus. Oh, man. Well, my situation I'm talking about. So now when my kids go to school, they're like, I need lunch money. And I fucking get online. Yeah. And I put like $20 on their books. It's just like putting money on an inmate's books at the prison. So I put money on their books. But when I was a kid, my dad would leave me $1.50 on the nightstand or on the end table, and I would take $1.50 to school, and I'd pay cash money for my lunch when I went to school.
Hell yeah, baller.
Yeah, dude. We lived a block away from a candy store that served.
Oh man, it was the best.
That served cheeseburgers, rib sandwiches, candy,
and penny candy. That was
Chico sticks. Mm-hmm. Cow tails.
That was like the neighborhood hang.
They had everything. And if you're lucky, if you could find someone drunk enough, they would buy you fucking scratch offs or booze.
Oh, whichever. They did not care.
I was there at like 11 years old. I could have had booze if I wanted. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
But it was called, first it was called Bill's, but then it was called Bud's Corner Market.
Yeah.
So my dad would do this fucking shit where he would leave a $10 bill on the table.
Mm-hmm.
I got 5 days of school. Lunch is about $2 a day. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. I had $2 for every day. So he would put a $10 bill that was supposed to last me the whole week.
Sure.
I would get lunch for $1.65 on Monday, and I would take my fat ass home. I would get off the bus, and I would walk straight to the candy store.
Straight to Bill's.
And Bud would be like, you want a burger?
You want a burger, fat boy? I know your ass wants a burger.
I know you're here for burgers and Chico sticks, you fat little fuck. And this dude would sit on an upside down, like, 5-gallon bucket, just hemorrhoids fucking hanging out of him, sitting there all, you know. I'm like, I'm going to have a cheeseburger today. And and the cheeseburgers were like $1.50 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one day they would cook the beef and then freeze it. And then when you wanted it, they would just microwave it and put it on a burger. And one day he's like, you know, for like 80 cents more, you can do a second patty. I'm just like, oh my God.
So, he's like playing to his audience.
Yeah, he was, dude. Oh, he was a porky little fucker, too. So, that day I got a fucking double, and then by Tuesday for lunch I didn't barely have enough to buy lunch at school
like the rest of the week.
Yeah. So then that night I'm just laying there panicked, dude. I'm just like, what the fuck, man? What the fuck? I'm he's gonna be so mad. So like 11 o'clock, after my parents went to sleep, I climbed down out of my bed. I've never told my parents this either. I climbed down out of my bed, and I got my little brother's jeans he was wearing that day. I took his fucking money. Motherfucker had like $8 because he only bought lunch for one day.
Please tell me you bought more cheeseburgers.
I did, dude. I was out of
You still didn't have money for lunch.
The next day, I got chicken sandwich at school.
Oh,
and then,
man,
I got off the bus and I bought another double decker. He's like, you want a second patty again today? I'll just put fucking like $5 up on me. Yeah, buddy. Yeah, pack it on there, bud.
We're going to get a pouch of the Big League Chew today, too. I got a little extra. Man. I mowed some lawns. It's fucking February. I mowed some lawns. Got some extra money. My dad's going to call me and be like, you're fucking stealing lunch money, brother. And I remember my little brother got in trouble, too. He's like, I don't know where I went. He's like, maybe someone stole it out of my pants. And then my mom's like, who would steal it out of your pants? My fat ass did. But we went back to the $2 a day schedule after that. After kept on dismissing, losing all his money, $10 at a time.
You started going hungry at school.
Yeah, he said, you fat fucks. Well, he said, pretty much me, you fat fuck, you're going to get $2 a day. That's all you're getting. What a sad story.
Oh, that's so funny.
What a hardworking man. He you know, he didn't frown at all. He just said, here's some more money. And the thing is like, if I'd been like, told my mom, hey, I want burgers tonight. She would make burgers every single night.
Right.
But the fact that I just like a grown up, walk my ass down to the carryout and buy myself a burger when I'm in the fucking, you know, fourth, fifth grade, felt like the shit. I felt like King Dingling.
Sure.
I had glass bottle Cokes there too.
Yeah, man, that place was the shit. It's such a hole in the wall, like,
yeah,
crappy ass place, but it was like, that was the thing you did when you were a kid, like in that neighborhood.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know how I got to that from where we are now, but he was afraid.
Talking about scared to tell your parents stuff.
Yeah. He was afraid to tell his wife that he'd fucked up at work. So instead of admitting his failure, he continued to get dressed every day and go to work. He would put on his clothes like he was going to work, and then he would drive to the train station.
Just fucking sleep.
He would ride the train a few stops, get off and walk around, and then ride a different train, and then he would come back at the end of the day. And I don't know if this guy listens to the podcast or not. I think he and his wife are past this, but they're dear good friends of the family. But he lost his job, and he was afraid to tell his wife.
Mm-hmm.
This motherfucker was going to the library, like the local library, every day, and he would just sit on the computer at the library because he didn't know where to go. And he would tell her he lost his job. I hope he doesn't listen. I'm not saying his name, but every day he would just go to the library and chill. And my wife told me about it. I said, what the fuck? He's going to get fucking murdered. So it's better just to come clean about these types of things.
Man.
It sucks.
I mean, how long are you going to do that until you're like, hey, you didn't get paid this week, honey? Oh, shit, I guess I got to talk to HR.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that last check was the last one. The last one we got, that was the last paycheck.
What have you been doing for the past 2 weeks?
Oh, I got a job at the library as a volunteer. I'm a stay-at-home son now. Eventually, he was able to secure another job, albeit this was a much, much lower paying job than he was accustomed to as a vice president of a bank. But he lost that low paying job almost immediately. This continued to happen over and over and over. He kept on taking these low paying jobs. Mm-hmm. He'd get fired. He'd take a low paying job. He would get fired. Obviously, the money he was making was not able to keep up with the lifestyle that he'd created for his wife and his family.
Right.
Eventually, he started skimming money from his mom's account. She had quite a nut of cash, and he was skimming money from her to help keep the house from going into foreclosure.
About time for her to earn her keep.
Yeah, it was. Come down here, you fat bitch. By 1971, he was practically completely bankrupt.
Oh, that sucks.
This was only 6 years after they moved into the Breeze Knoll Mansion.
Wow.
And here's our first snippet of audio of John List.
God, look at that cross eye. Holy shit.
Yeah, his wife had a really lazy eye.
She was trashed.
She's ripped right there. But in this interview, he's in his 80s, I believe. So just keep that in mind. This isn't what he sounded like his entire life.
Look at those kids.
I guess I was sort of beaten down from the failures that I had had. And I was ashamed to let anybody know.
He would get...
So he said he was bummed out from all that, like just letting his family down. That's why he was afraid to tell them. He was just like the failures. He just didn't want to tell them.
I completely sympathize with that. It
sucks to let your entire family down, dude.
It's like a humiliating thing.
It is, because you're supposed to be the one. Yeah. And, but devout Lutherans believe that poverty itself is absolutely a sin. And it presented a deep moral crisis for John List, because morally and religiously, he couldn't go on welfare. It was too humiliating. And it wasn't the aspect of going on welfare wasn't like, you know, sinful.
Mm-hmm.
His father had created such an environment inside his brain growing up that you must always take care of your family. And if you don't take care of your family,
you will be shunned from the world. You will never, ever amount to anything if you can't take care of your family. So in the back of his mind, he's hearing his dad, like, if you can't take care of your fucking family, you shouldn't even, you're not even worth being alive. You shouldn't even be around anymore. But by this time, when he lost his job, he had three teenagers in the house. Much like today's day and age, the kids started becoming interested in things that weren't necessarily things that John were interested in himself. Mm-hmm. You know, so right now I hear songs coming from my preteen's room and I'm just like, that is the dumbest fucking shit I've ever heard in my life. And kids are just into shit that we're not into. And it's going to...
There's some whores in this house. There's some whores in this house.
Yeah. Like that. Some of that. Yeah.
Some WAP.
Yeah, WAP. WAP. There is no WAP being played in my preteen's bedroom. I promise you that.
My son this morning, or no, last night, he was like, Dad, look how bad this kid is. And it was this little kid. He was dressed in a Spider-Man outfit. And he was playing one of the Spider-Man games, and the Spider-Man did like his little backflip and landed in a superhero position. And he was like, oh shit, I can do that shit, watch. And it was like a little 5-year-old kid, and he did a backflip and landed it in the superhero position. And he was like, see, I did that shit. And I was like, beat that kid's ass. Yeah,
you can't let your kids run wild like that. This ain't Hulkamania. We can't be running wild doing shit like that, you know? God, beat your fucking kids so someone else doesn't have to. What's heartbreaking for John, his daughter Patricia had expressed her interest and intent to go into acting once she left high school. John believed that this was a very dirty and corrupt way to live your life as far as his religious views. He thought actors were the scum of the universe. It was a very sleazy way of making a living, and it wasn't something that he thought his daughter should be doing.
Sure.
He was also starting to hear rumors that his daughter Patricia was dabbling in witchcraft.
Hell yes.
And she was experimenting with marijuana.
Oh, no, not marijuana.
La-da-da-da-da. She was smoking it. She was snorting it, shooting it, smoking it. She was doing it all, man, with the marijuanas. THC.
Don't get started with the marijuanas.
And he was hearing the rumors and the rumblings going on that she was smoking reefer, which everybody was smoking reefer in the late 60s. Everybody. Even my dad smoked a bong in the 60s.
I don't know that for a fact. I'm sure he did. I could see your dad getting down.
No, he was born in 58, so I would say about 1970, 1971 is when he started to hit his true stride.
If he grew up in Northridge too, he was smoking weed.
He didn't. He's from this town right here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He's still smoking. He was getting it from the kids.
Right? Yeah. No, I remember whenever we were helping him clean out the garage one time, my older brother found a bowl and a toolbox in there.
Uh-huh.
And this bowl was so old it like disintegrated in my brother's hand.
Hell yeah.
But my brother started making fun of my dad, and my dad's like, that ain't my fucking shit, boy. That ain't my fucking pipe. Oh, smoke crack, man.
But he goes a drawer down and just finds a bunch of needles.
That's the shit right there, boy. Man. Oh, so he's got this daughter that's like smoking marijuana, doing witchcraft stuff. So at this point, you can imagine how utterly fucked up this family is. And you gotta think about this in your head for a second. The husband's like a two-tour war veteran, World War II, Bible thumping, Korean War, fucking murderer, just killed people in the war. The mom has an eye so lazy that it can't even get up for work in the morning. She's fucking drunk all the time. He's presumably got the family so upside down in debt, and there's just no money, and they're living in this huge mansion. So you can imagine what the environment was like in this house at this point. These kids are probably so fucked up and just don't like, you know, if your kids see the household spiraling out of control, they don't look up to the parents, I don't think.
Yeah. You
gotta portray a strong... My kids...
They're like, fuck, you got to hold it together. Come on, guys. Yeah. We're fucking kids.
And he got to the point that he's like telling these kids, you kids need to go get jobs to learn maturity. But he really wanted them to get jobs so they could help pay the fucking bills because they were so messed up with the money. while things were obviously going bad in his, for Johnny and his children, things were about to get even worse for Lazy Eye Helen. Since moving into the mansion, she had hidden the fact that she was suffering from blackout migraines and passing out.
Yeah, no.
And from looks of the picture, she was definitely fucking blacking out.
She hit her head a couple times.
She had a migraine for sure. Her health altogether was deteriorating at an exceptionally fast rate. She had many of these health complications from John on top. On top of being a raging fucking drunk, mm-hmm. she's got all these health complications that are just compacting on top of all of it. It was even reported that she was experiencing near complete vision loss in her right eye. Which,
looking at that thing, I could definitely tell.
In order to sedate herself, she was drinking heavily and she was becoming dependent on tranquilizers.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, it's a bad bitch. Apparently, before her first husband died in the Korean War, he gave her a little parting gift. And what do I mean by a parting gift? In the winter of 1968 through 1969, tests revealed that she had contracted syphilis.
Oh, no.
Oh.
How did she get that?
It had reached the stage of tertiary syphilis, which I looked up tertiary syphilis.
Is that where you fuck a turkey?
No, yeah, it's a turducken. Different.
Okay.
This tertiary syphilis, these fucking people's faces were falling off and shit. Apparently, when you get syphilis...
There's different strains of syphilis?
Apparently, there is. If you don't catch syphilis soon enough and just let it go, it turns into this. Your fucking eye goes lazy, because that's why her eye was so messed up and lazy, and she looked like a catfish, because she had syphilis.
Like a hammerhead shark.
It was like tertiary syphilis. It turned into... Their faces start to fall off, dude. That's how
That's
how bad syphilis can get.
Yeah. If you've had syphilis that bad, send us an email, brohiopodcast.com.
If your face has ever fallen off from syphilis, we want to hear from you. And yeah, I did look up the pictures. It's quite disgusting. Damn. It takes many years for syphilis to rear its head after you've contracted it. So she got the syphilis from her husband that was in the Korean War, and it didn't start to show itself until many, I guess, 15, 20.
Fucked one of them little Korean boys.
Right, exactly. He said, I like you. Wow. God, what's the fucking, it's an Asian little boy joke. Oh, God. It's so bad. I can't remember. Even if I could remember it, it would be too bad to say it. I'll remember it and tell you when we're done.
Okay.
Now, to save herself the embarrassment, she stopped going to church. Some believe this was due to her mental instability, but some believe that it was to save herself he lost his job and they were kind of losing all their money. She was just embarrassed to go to church, live in the fanciest house on the block.
Yeah.
And at this point, John would not put his mind to rest. He has a daughter dabbling in witchcraft and injecting marijuanas. His wife is living off tranquilizers and butt ice. I presume she was drinking butt ice. Anyone with an eye that looks like it's doing 50-pound curls is definitely drinking butt ice. He has presumably lost every penny to his name, and bankruptcy is completely inevitable. But being a deep man of faith, John just cannot fathom the thought of the family being dependent on welfare and charity. One thing that John did think about was taking his own life, but this is what he had to say about that.
Okay.
I felt that if you committed suicide, you would automatically go to hell.
Right.
And that's what he believed in his faith. How fucking stimulating does he sound? So he's, like I said, he's really old in this interview, but that's John List himself. He's he's not alive now, but...
Something interesting that someone that... I'd kind of been talking to on the YouTube comments here just said, they said, my super Mormon coworker showed me your podcast. Hell yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. Wait till we do the, one day we're going to do an episode about the Mormon cartel battle going on in Northern Mexico. It is a wild one, dude. They're fucking killing each other down there. It's great. It's super. Why are there Mormons in Northern Mexico? The Brohio will have the answer for that.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's what he had to say about, he presumed that you kill yourself, you automatically go to hell.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty much the narrative.
Yeah, it's the ultimate sin in his eyes. So John, being the thinker that he was, meticulously, and he was OCD down to the core, man, meticulously, painlessly worked out a huge plan to solve all of his problems. So he had an answer to all of his problems at this point. We're about to take you through that plan real quick.
Sweet.
On the morning of November 9th, 1971, the children had made their way to school much like they did every other day. Nothing was out of the normal that day.
I had just gotten myself so convinced that this was what I had to do that I was going to go through with the whole program.
And what was that program, you ask? Well, Helen woke up and she came downstairs for her morning coffee. Just like every other morning, John and her made small talk, presumably getting up, and at this point he would start to get ready for work. This time, though, was a little bit different. John retrieved a 9mm automatic pistol that his father had given to him. He walked up behind Helen and he shot her in the back of the head, killing her instantly.
Damn.
This is his wife with the lazy eye. This is not her. This is him talking about it.
I came back in, said a few words to Helen, and went into the front room. Then I came around back and shot her in the head.
Listen. I'm surprised he's able to blow her head off with a puny little 9mm.
Puny little wiener.
That big ass head.
No, you gotta shoot her a bunch of times to get her to die.
Fuck.
No, he didn't. After he killed her, John placed her body on top of a sleeping bag. Well, he placed her in a sleeping bag, and he dragged her into the grand ballroom of the Breeze Knoll Mansion. He laid her beneath the stained glass Tiffany ceiling.
Oh, come on. That's just overdoing it.
No, wait. It gets better. Come to find out later. I'll leave this information out right here, and then I will tell you later why it makes sense.
Okay.
So he laid her in the grand ballroom of the Tiffany stained glass ceiling. He then proceeded to go upstairs to his mother's apartment. When he arrived upstairs, his 84-year-old mother, Alma, fat-ass Alma, asked about the noise downstairs that she had just heard. John gave her a very vague answer. He gave her a kiss, put the gun to her left temple, pulled the trigger, and killed her instantly
as
well.
That's gangster.
She got over and, you know, greeted me and gave me a kiss. And she said, "What was that noise?" At that point, I felt like a Judas, having, you know, kissed her too. And I said, "Oh, it must have been some noise out in the back. That's why I came up." She started going into the attic area, and as she got to the doorway, I killed her.
So he shot his mom in the temple.
Whew.
At this point, he smoked his wife in the back of the head, killed his own mom.
Smoked his meatloaf of an in-law mom.
It wasn't his in-law. This was his mom.
Oh, his mom. That's right.
Yeah, this is his
right.
own
right.
mother, man. He had a really close relationship with her as well.
Damn.
But he found out that his mom was too big for him to drag all the way to the ballroom.
Jeez.
I told you, fat-ass Alma. They called her Alma the Llama because she was as big as a fucking... she was as big as a llama. That's why they gave her that little sweet nickname. So instead of... instead of putting her in a sleeping bag or letting her, he just left her where she was at and he put a towel over her face.
That's so sad.
It is very sad. When John arrived back downstairs, he was shocked by the incredible amount of blood that was in the kitchen from where he had shot his wife priorly.
Well, yeah, you shoot someone in the fucking head, they bleed.
He spent a substantial amount of time cleaning up all of the blood in the kitchen. Here's what he has to say about that.
I was very surprised. As amount of blood that, you know, drained out. And I think there was some shell casing and some of her false teeth had gotten broken and were out on both the table and on the floor. And I cleaned all that up.
So,
God,
this guy is... this is a fucking cold-blooded murderer right here. He's talking about this so matter-of-factly. Just, and he's kind of hard to understand. He's a little, sounds like Jim Ross, but he's got a little bit of a,
yeah, he had the cerebral palsy.
Sounds like he got a flat tire on the back end. He's just dragging everything along.
Yeah, it's like post-seizure, or
post-stroke.
Stroke, there you go.
And he's talking about it, and he says that her false teeth had been knocked out after he shot her in the back of the head, that her teeth were in pieces all over the floor.
Gosh.
And everyone knows how much I fucking love teeth. That is no bueno. I do not want to think about that for even 10 seconds.
Especially false teeth.
But he had a very meticulous plan, like I stated before. After he cleaned up the kitchen, he proceeded to write notes and make phone calls to his children's teachers, his boss, and others, telling him that there was a plan being put in place for him and his family to go tend to a sick relative in North Carolina. And I do believe the actual fact was Helen's mother lived in North Carolina, okay, and she was indeed sick, so this was verifiable. But he went to the post office and he mailed the letters out. That tells you how that's very telling of the times right there, that he wrote these letters to his kids' teachers and his boss, and he dropped them in the mail. Electronic mail. He just had to go to the post office and drop them off. But while he was at the post office, he put a stop mail delivery request for his address for the mansion, so the mail would not pile up at the house and people would become suspicious. Because that's a good indicator. If you have elderly neighbors, people kind of in bad health, if their mail starts to fucking pile up at their mailbox, that's a good sign they're dead inside. So keep. And that was one thing. We'd oftentimes get those calls a lot when I worked at the police department. Someone would say, Glenda hasn't been outside in 2 weeks and her mail is starting, and her newspapers are piling up. And then you go to the window and you're like, yeah, I smell her in there. She's dead for sure. She's dead. Now, that's a good indicator that someone's passed away inside the house. That, and if there's a dead body inside, that's a really good indicator that somebody's passed away in the house.
That's usually a good
He also arranged to have their milk delivery stopped, which I wish that was still a thing.
Oh, my gosh, that'd milk delivery. Cool.
And he also arranged to have the newspaper delivery stopped as well. Also, while running his errands, he dropped by the bank and cashed in his mother's $2,000 savings bond because she would no longer be needing that.
Damn it.
She was going to treat the family to a Chinese takeout, but never fucking got around to it. And to help you understand the incredible nerve of this chump, this fucking asshole, John List, after he was completed running errands, this is the nerve of this guy, he went back to the house and made himself a sandwich and waited for his children to arrive home. And he tells you about this right here.
Wow.
I don't believe that while I was eating, especially at lunchtime, that I had any feelings of, no, I should stop, not go any farther with this. I just felt that once I had started, it was incumbent upon me to kill all of the children so that not even one of them would remain and suffer the trauma that they would go through knowing that the rest of the family had been killed.
Oh, how thoughtful. What a fucking saint.
This guy is cold-blooded. He doesn't realize the gravity of what he's done. But you heard him say right there, he's like, I'm killing all these fucking kids. I'm not quitting.
Oh, man.
But the best part about all that is he's working this out over a turkey sandwich that he made for himself. He's just sitting there eating lunch. He still has to go about his day. He's like, I don't know, I just fucking killed these people. I work with people like this, but
yeah,
they have a routine, and if they get off their routine, oh my God, Lord have mercy. And he didn't want to be off of his routine. Like, I gotta sit down and eat lunch. And he said it wasn't foreign to him because they would kill people in the field in Korea in World War II, and then they would just come back and eat like it with fucking blood still all over him. And he said it didn't bother me. He was desensitized for sure because everything that he endured in the war doesn't make an excuse for it. But now, while waiting for his children to arrive home, he received a phone call from the school. It was his daughter, Patricia, and she said she wasn't feeling well. This is the one that was doing witchcraft and marijuana, so there's no telling what she had put inside of her body at this time to inflict such illness upon herself, but it was probably her own goddamn fault for experimenting with dangerous-ass drugs. In my personal opinion, and that's how I feel, and that's what I believe. Not to mention, she probably had chicken bones in her fucking purse because she was a witch. And everyone knows, we don't like people with puffy nipples listening to this fucking podcast. So if you got puffy nipples, turn it off. If you're a witch, that's cool. We like that. That's hot.
And, yes, it is.
And he obliged. He went to the school and he picked up Patricia. He brought her home, and once they got inside, immediately John shot her in the jaw with an antique 22 caliber pistol.
Holy shit.
This gun was a souvenir that he kept for himself during his time of war. And much like his wife, he then dragged her body into the ballroom and laid her on a sleeping bag right next to her mother. The next child to arrive home was Fred. Fred was about to be dead. As soon as Fred arrived home...
Damn it.
As soon as Fred arrived home, his father, John, shot him in the head as well and laid his body next to his sister's body, Patricia, on top of a sleeping bag as well. So they had a lot of sleeping bag. That's one thing to, I don't know.
that's going out of style nowadays.
I don't know how that all ties in here at the end, but there are definitely a lot of sleeping bags. Not after John was done, but there were a lot.
They did a lot of camping.
His son, John Jr., and this is where it gets fucking bad, dude. His son, John Jr., had a soccer game at school that day. John Sr., the one we're talking about, actually drove to the field, watched his son play in his last soccer game, cheering him on the entire time. He said that John was even playing a very good game that day. After the game, he gave John Jr. a ride home. Once they got inside, John Sr. shot John Jr. in the back of the skull. This murder wasn't quite as clean as the other ones, as John Jr. began to put up quite the fight.
Oh, shit.
So much of a fight that John Sr. had to shoot him 9 more times before actually killing him, his own son, and right here he talks about that as well.
All the others, they just, dropped. So I knew they were dead. With John, I don't know whether it was a muscle reaction that caused him to jerk around a little bit. But then I shot several more times.
It was later determined that List shot his son 10 times. He claims, though, that John, like the rest, did not suffer.
That was the one thing I was trying to prevent, was their feeling any wounds or suffering, at the last moment. How compassionate, huh?
Hear him laughing right there at the end?
I can assure you, once his son got shot once in the head, he wasn't sitting there coming in his pants. he was definitely suffering.
Yeah, listen, I'm going to play this again. He says, how much compassion, huh?
Yeah.
He starts laughing.
How compassionate, huh?
Jeez.
I want to fuck his mouth. Like, I'm not the nice kind either. I want him to take his dentures out, and I want to ruin his gums. What a piece of shit, dude.
Yeah, fuck this guy.
Ultimate scumbag. Ugh. So he had to shoot his son, John Jr., 9 times before. Good for John Jr. for putting up a fight. And
10 times total.
God, struggling through all
that.
Wow. Yeah. He then dragged John's body into the ballroom as well and laid him next to the rest of the family. John then stood over their bodies and said a prayer from a Lutheran hymnal. There's another snippet right here of audio from John.
I think after I had shot John and cleaned up, I felt such a measure of relief that this plot that I had was carried out without being interrupted. That I more or less relaxed after that.
One of the...
He was...
Oh, okay. That's good to know. Glad you were relaxed after wiping out your entire fucking bloodline.
And that's what he said, man. He's just like... I was at peace with it. I was happy that the fucking plan, the biggest hitch in his entire plan was the last person he shot jitterbugged a little bit after he got shot. He fucking flopped around like a dead fish after he got shot a little bit. Because I can assure you, he was probably dead after the first fucking bullet to the back of the head. And he was completely at peace with everything he had done.
Wow.
So much so, he was such a fucking... anal retentive asshole. He worked to clean up all the blood that he had created at the crime scene the best he could. After he was done cleaning up the blood, he made himself dinner and sat down to eat the dinner.
Dude, fuck this guy. Seriously.
Having been in combat, we were out killing and fighting, and then we'd come in and have something to eat. I think that's what allowed me to eat peacefully in the room that I had killed my family.
Ah, cool.
So he was trained for this. After he was done with dinner, he did the goddamn dishes and then he went to bed. In a later interview, he said that he slept better that night than he had slept in many years.
Oh, my God.
That night, I may not have slept 100% soundly, but I think I got probably a better night's rest than I had the night before all this happened.
Ah, okay.
He was cool with it, man. Now, the next morning, he started working towards an escape plan, and he had put a lot of meticulous planning into this. Most of the time, murderers don't really have a plan after they commit. They're just like, their goal is to work towards killing someone.
Yeah.
And then the plan doesn't go any further than that. Like, oh, I actually killed him. Now what the fuck do I do? John here, he had a plan. Now, at this point, he turned the air conditioning down in the house as low as it would go in order to preserve the bodies and keep them from stinking and alerting neighbors.
Okay.
He turned on every light in the house and turned up his favorite radio station, which was some kind of classical bullshit, so any intruders might think that someone was indeed inside the home. It was then that he decided he was going to write a 5-page confession letter to his pastor. Now, we have that letter right here. It says, I am sorry to add this to the additional burden to your work. I know that what has been done is wrong from all that I have been taught, and that any reason that I might give will not make it right. But you are the only person that I know that, while not condoning this, will at least possibly understand why I felt that I had to do this. I wasn't earning anywhere near enough to support us. Everything I tried seemed to fall to pieces. True, we could have gone bankrupt and maybe gone on welfare, too, but that brings me to the next point. Knowing the type of location that one would have to live in, plus the environment for the children, plus the effect on them knowing they were on welfare, was just more than they could and should endure. I'm sorry. I know they are willing to cut back, but this involved a lot more than that. With Pat being so determined to get into acting, I was so fearful as to what that might do to her continuing to be a Christian. I'm sure it wouldn't have helped. Also, with Helen not going to church, I knew that this would harm the children eventually in their attendance. I continue to hope that she would begin to come to church soon. But when I mentioned her to Mr. Jutz, wanted to pay her an elder's call, she just blew up and she wanted to have her name taken off the church rolls. Again, this could only have an adverse result for the children's continued attendance. So that is the sum of it. If any of one of these had been the condition, we might have pulled through, but this was just too much. At least I'm certain that they all have gone to heaven now. If things had gone on, who knows if this would be the case. Of course, Mother got involved because doing what I did to my family would have been a tremendous shock to her at this age. Therefore, knowing that she is also a Christian, I felt it best that she would be relieved of the troubles of this world that would have hit her. After it was all over, I said some prayers for them all from the hymn book. That was the least that I could do. Now for the final arrangements. Helen and the children have all agreed that they would prefer to be cremated. Please see to it that the costs are kept low. For Mother, she has a plot at the Frankenmuth Church. These are all the arrangements. I don't need to read all that. Also, I don't know what will happen to the books and personal things, but to the extent possible, I'd like for them to be distributed as you see fit. Some books might go to the school or church library. What a fucking dumbass, dude. Originally, I'd planned this for November 1st, All Saints Day, but travel arrangements were delayed. I thought it would be an appropriate day for them to go to heaven. As for me, please let me be dropped from the congregation rolls. I leave myself...
So thoughtful.
That's the worst he thinks is going to happen to him. I leave myself in the hand of God's justice and mercy. I don't doubt that he is able to help us, but apparently he saw fit not to answer my prayers the way that I'd hoped they would be answered. This makes me think that perhaps it was for the best as far as the children's souls are concerned. I know that many will only look at the additional years that they could have lived, but if finally they were no longer Christians, what would have been gained? Also, I'm sure many will say, how could anyone do such a horrible thing? My only answer is that it isn't easy and was only done after much thought. Pastor, Mrs. Morris may possibly be reached at 802 Pleasant Hill Drive, home of her sister. One other thing, it may seem cowardly to have always shot from behind, but I didn't want any of them to know, even at the last second, that I had done this to them. That's fucking heavy shit right there, dude.
Man.
John got hurt more because he seemed to struggle longer. The rest were immediately out of pain. John didn't consciously feel anything either. Please remember me in your prayers. I will need them whether or not the government does its duty as it sees fit. I'm only concerned while making my peace with God, and of this I am assured because of Christ dying even for me. P.S. Mother is in the hallway in the attic, third floor. She was too heavy to move.
Love, John.
Oh, man.
Isn't that bad, dude?
What a guy.
Now, after he penned the letter, the psychopathic asshole went to every family photo in the house and cut his face out of all of the family photos. Now, at first, I thought this was some kind of symbolic thing of his way of removing himself from the family for good. But that's not the case. This was before social media, before surveillance cameras, all that. By doing this, if and when the police ever arrived to the residence, they would have no fucking idea what he looked like. They didn't have friends. They didn't socialize. No one had pictures or videos of him. They never got out. They never did anything. There would be no record of what he looked like. Because even back then, you didn't get your picture on your driver's license. You just got your driver's license with your name on it.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So he was taking away the ability to enhance the investigation. He was completely impeding the police by... They would have no idea what he looked like. So he cut his face out of every single family picture in the house.
Hmm.
Yeah. He then hopped on a bus. Well, before he got on the bus, to throw them off his trail even further, he left the house and he locked the door. Then he drove to the JFK International Airport and he left his car there. He didn't get on a plane. He then hopped on a bus back into the city. From that point, he took a train to Denver, Colorado. He went and stayed in a motel, and he created a new name for himself, Robert Clark. He even applied for a new Social Security card, which he got.
Oh, shit.
And he started his new life as a short order cook, cooking burgers at a little diner on the outskirts of town.
Man, things were so much easier back in the day.
Jesus. All while he was starting his new life, the old Breeze Knoll mansion sat full of dead bodies. All the lights were on in the house, giving the idea and the illusion that it was full of life. But the neighbors started to grow suspicious. Why? Because all of the light bulbs in the house started to burn out one by one by one. But these people were such shut-ins that no one actually really noticed that they were gone. There wasn't a huge cause for alarm by this. After about a month of no sign of anyone from the family, Patricia's drama teacher became very concerned. When interviewed, he said he couldn't shake the feeling that something bad had happened to Patricia. And he got this feeling for a fucking good reason. Before she left, Patricia told the drama teacher that she thought that her dad was going to kill the entire family.
Wow.
Which was a huge red flag. But apparently, a few days before the murder, they were all sitting at the dinner table. And just out of the blue, you know how like unsociable and weird he was. Out of the blue, he was like, "What do you guys want done with your bodies after you're dead?" He just asked him that at the dinner table. Just like, "What do you want your arrangements to be?"
Such fun, optimistic dinner conversation.
No warming up to it. Just said, "What do you guys want done with your bodies after you're dead?" And there has to be a lead up to that conversation. You can't just go into that one. It's cold, you know?
Yeah.
It has to be a bit of a lead up.
That's really weird.
The drama teacher was actually able to convince another teacher to go with him to the List family house. Obviously, the neighbors saw strange characters walking around the mansion, which were the teachers, and peering through the windows, so they called the police. The first officers to respond were Officers George Selznick and Charles Holler. After they arrived at the scene, they walked around the mansion. Nothing looked out of place. Nothing looked like there was forced entry. But they weren't really seeing anything from the outside. So they started beating on the windows and knocking on the doors with no answer. This is where it gets a little unlawful, you know, kind of gray area. But apparently some neighbors that were walking around the house as well found an open window. And they alerted the police and said, "Hey, we found an open window," because the police didn't have probable cause.
Yeah, to go in.
Yes. So after much, and that's even in the police report, the neighbors kind of pushed them along, said, "You have to go through this window." So after much encouragement from the neighbors, the two police officers went inside the mansion. They climbed through the quote unquote unlocked window. The officers noted that the house was almost completely pitch black inside, and the air inside was absolutely frigid. Unlike Rob's mother-in-law, not frigid. The most eerie part for the officers, it sounded like there was funeral music playing loudly inside the home, but it was actually just that crusty-ass classical music that John liked to listen to. Once they got to the ballroom, there was a curtain separating them from the bodies. Once they drew the curtain back, they were greeted with the overwhelming smell of decomposing bodies. Laid neatly on a sleeping bag is the entire family except for John. The officers continued to search the residence, finding the confession letter, the guns used, and directions to Fat Alma upstairs. Immediately, they put out a bolo or a be on the lookout for John List. At this point, he had already hopped a fucking train, hopped a bus, not got on a plane, made it look like he was on a plane, and he was in Denver, Colorado. This, and I kind of skimmed over it quickly, what is happening right here is a month after he actually killed these people. A month after he actually killed them. His car was quickly discovered at JFK Airport, but there were no records of him flying anywhere. Their only lead at this point was completely dead, and the only lead was the car in the parking lot at JFK International Airport. They had no idea where this man went. The August following the murders, so I think the murders happened in November, the following August, the vacant mansion burned to the ground in what investigators believe was an arson attack. So somebody burnt the mansion down. And this is where I started to make the reference to the stained glass ceiling. Mm-hmm. After the fire, it was discovered that the stained glass ceiling was autographed and signed by Louis Comfort Tiffany himself, the owner of Tiffany Jewelry, and that that specific antique would have fetched close to $1 million in money, our money today. I think like 200,000 back then, 100, 200,000 back then. But it would have brought close to between $600,000 to $1 million in our money now, which would have solved all of his money issues at the time.
Ouch.
And he didn't know that the fucking ceiling, with the pieces of the ceiling were signed by Louis Comfort Tiffany himself. Like I said, John at this point was long fucking gone, never to be seen or heard from again. The police had zero to go off of and zero there. They were just fumbling through the dark, man. It was becoming a cold case. And I told you in the beginning of the episode, this was the cleanest mass murder that I've ever seen pulled off. This guy got a month head start killing his entire family by pulling the milk, pulling the newspaper, doing the mail hold, making everyone know that they were going to be out of town for an extended period of time. He completely set the table. He did a good job.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but yeah.
Yeah, I hate to pat him on the back, but he did do a good job. They tried to keep it in the public eye, but it was just a dying attempt at this point. They tried to put it on Unsolved Mysteries, which was refused as well. The case grew cold for almost 18 years. Finally, in 1989, there was a new show that was coming out called America's Most Wanted.
Yeah, buddy.
With John Walsh.
Uh-huh.
Captain Frank Baranka of the Union County Prosecutor's Office thought this would be the perfect opportunity to get this case to a larger audience. And this was in hopes of securing a new lead at this point. The thing was, they pitched it to America's Most Wanted, and the show turned them down because usually in America's Most Wanted, they have something, some little bit of information. They really didn't even know how to, like, no one, they didn't have a picture of this guy. They didn't know, like, people were so just pushed away from him. They couldn't even describe what the fuck he looked like. They had nothing to tell the public, hey, this is what you're looking for. So America's Most Wanted's like, no, I think we're probably going to pass on this one. So they did initially pass, like I said, but then the fucking man himself, John Walsh, he caught wind of what was going on. John Walsh had a soft spot for this murder due to the fate of his 6-year-old. It's kind of an infamous story. His son, 6-year-old son Adam, was murdered, and he thought this motherfucker deserved to have justice served to him, which he did. John List did. In an interview, John Walsh would call List a son of a bitch, a coward, and a child killer. I watched that interview that they're talking about, and he's like, I hope that motherfucker fries. Like, he let it all hang out.
He's pissed. Yeah. Good.
But not to get too far ahead of themselves, they needed a picture or image of what he would look like in 1989. John Walsh tapped his friend Frank Bender, a forensic sculptor, to create an age-progressed sculpture of what John would look like in 1989. They called him called it a bust. I've never heard it called that before.
Yeah.
But they wanted to create a bust of what John List would look like in 1989. They utilized standard facial reconstruction measurements, much like other forensic anthropologists would use. They also reached out to psychologist Richard Walter to get a detailed psychological profile of John List. He went as far as getting pictures of John List's parents to see how their faces had aged and compared them to what he thought John would look like at the age. Well, he would be like in his 60s at this point. So this fucking guy, he takes the pictures of the parents, and he's totally going off of what people said he looked like. He's making this bust, and all he's using is the pictures of the mom and dad, of John List's mom and dad, and what he thinks that he should look like based off the descriptions that people had provided to him. Not very much to go off of.
Yeah, definitely
not. But nonetheless, he's got also a psychological profile after working with the psychologist of what the guy would fucking, how John would do his hair, what kind of glasses he would wear, and all this ties in together. He uses all this information along with his intuition. They created a bust or a sculpture of what John would look like now in his 60s. But they knew they needed a pair of glasses that would match those of John List. Knowing John's personality, Bender, the sculptor, scoured thrift stores in hopes of finding the perfect pair of frames that matched John List's psychological profile. Conservative, with thick black frames. Once he found the perfect frames, the sculpture was complete. The John List episode on America's Most Wanted aired on May 21st, 1989. God. It was believed to have had 22 million people viewing that episode that evening.
Dang.
Including two folks by the name of Wanda Flannery and her daughter Ava Mitchell in Denver, Colorado, where his name was John List, but Clark or whatever. I forget what his new name was. Whatever. But here's this little snippet from YouTube.
Okay.
I saw the tail end of it. I saw.
Okay. Set this real quick. This is John List talking about him walking into the fucking living room and seeing the tail end of America's Most Wanted, of them doing an episode on him.
Excuse me.
From his home in Richmond.
I saw the tail end of it. I saw that it was about me, and then saw the bust that they had. I was surprised at how accurate it was.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that they had that technology.
That looks really, really almost spot on.
That's great, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow.
That's uncanny.
That's impressive.
Yeah, they had nothing to go off of.
Except potentially what he would look like based off of his parents' looks.
And what people said he looked like.
Yeah.
And they also didn't know that he wore these glasses.
He looks a lot like the one grandpa that Johnny Knoxville played in that movie.
All Bad Grandpa?
Bad Grandpa, yeah.
Yeah.
He looked a lot like that bust looked like that.
They did not even, Wanda Flannery and her daughter Ava Mitchell, they didn't even need to see the sculpture before they assured one another that the description matched their former neighbor, Bob Clark, which is right. John List changed his name to Bob Clark.
There you go.
Their former neighbor was soft-spoken He was always wearing a suit. He was an accountant, and he was a devout Lutheran. When the sculpture of John List was shown on their screen, the two ladies nearly fell out of their chairs and their jaws nearly hit the ground. Everything was perfect right down to the glasses. They immediately called the tip line for America's Most Wanted. 11 days later, the FBI showed up at the home of Bob Clark in Richmond, Virginia.
11 days after that. That's awesome.
By this time, John List had a new wife by the name of Dolores, who had no fucking idea what was going on.
Ouch.
She's just trying to ride some old wiener. She greeted the FBI at the door and advised them that Bob Clark was at work. I mean, she didn't have any fucking clue who John List was.
Damn.
John List met Dolores at a church function. John List was, again, a Sunday school teacher at this point, and he also ran the church carpool, driving fellow churchgoers back and forth that could not drive themselves back and forth to church. The FBI then responded to the alleged place of employment of Bob Clark. There, they met the killer face-to-face for the first time. They asked him if he was Bob Clark, to which he replied yes. They asked him if he was John List, and he vehemently denied that. He even continued to deny it after his fingerprints were found to be a match to the prints taken from John List when he applied for a handgun permit.
Oops.
John List was eventually arrested and charged with 5 counts of first-degree murder.
Fuck him.
His trial began April 2nd, 1990, almost 18 and a half years after he was after he murdered his entire family. During the trial... Sorry, I just get a little death nut in there for a second. During the trial, List was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. This was a diagnosis given by court psychiatrist. His defense argued that this made him only guilty of second degree murder. They also argued in court that the day the bodies were found, all that evidence was was admissible because the police entered the residence unlawfully. Because you will remember that the neighbors summoned them through the unlocked window that
right.
probably wasn't an unlocked window.
Yeah.
During the trial, John testified that his financial difficulties had reached a crisis level in 1971 when he was let go from the bank. He couldn't bear the thought of sharing what transpired with a job to his family. List also testified that he encouraged his children to get part-time jobs so they could learn responsibility and maturity. In actuality, he was just trying to keep the family financially afloat.
I saw the tail end of it.
Okay, I already played that fucking part. Whatever. The court-appointed psychiatrist said that List only solved two possibilities to solve the problems that he had. Either accept being on welfare or kill his family and send their souls to heaven. That's what he said to the court psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. Here's the link I'm looking at.
I kept thinking about it for several weeks, I'm sure, maybe even a month. And my final solution was that if I would kill them, that would save them from any problems.
Yeah, he sure saved them from a lot of problems.
What a saint.
And this is from Wikipedia. Welfare was an unacceptable option. He reasoned because it would expose him and his family to ridicule and violate his authoritarian father's teachings regarding the care and protection of family members. Finally, on April 11th, after 9 hours of deliberation, the jury found him guilty on all 5 counts of first-degree murder. They gave him the maximum sentence of 5 consecutive life terms because of the death penalty, he wasn't eligible for that. The courtroom cheered for joy when his sentence was read aloud. John Walsh was pissed off that he was not sentenced to the death penalty. After several appeals, he finally gave up on the legal process, living out the rest of his life in prison. And what does John List have to say about his life in prison?
I have a job that I enjoy doing, and I feel I'm contributing at least something here. I feel it's safer in here than being out in the public, the way some people drive with road anger and these people that just kill people at random.
Oh, yeah.
They're much safer here.
Isn't that the sickest fucking shit you've ever heard, dude?
Yeah, you got to worry about all the people killing people at random.
Random, all the anger at driving. Now, he did die. John List died from pneumonia at the age of 82 on March 21st, 2008 in a New Jersey facility. And he said that hopefully this is what happens whenever he gets to heaven.
I think I will go to heaven. I don't know what the situation will be in heaven. Will there, they will remember what I did to them? Certainly, yeah. If we're all in heaven, I'm sure we would forgive each other for whatever harm we had done to each other here.
He said we will forgive each other for whatever harm we did to one another.
If heaven is real and if that happened to me, I would be so fucking salty. I'd be like, motherfucker, you killed me.
Yeah, dude.
Like, I don't want anything to do with you in this life or the afterlife or any of that shit.
Now, listen to this mindfuck right here.
All
right. This is from Wikipedia. In 1972, List was proposed as a suspect in the D.B. Cooper air piracy case because of the timing of his disappearance.
Oh, okay.
2 weeks prior to his airline, to the airline hijacking. Multiple matches to the hijacker's description and the reasoning that a, quote, fugitive accused of mass murder has nothing to lose. Another factor that made List a suspect was that Cooper demanded $200,000, which would have been enough to amortize the mortgage of Breeze Knoll and List's other debts. List was questioned by the FBI investigators after his capture, but he denied any involvement in the Cooper case. While his name is still occasionally mentioned in Cooper articles and documentaries, no direct evidence implicates him, and the FBI no longer considers him a suspect.
That's pretty cool.
I think he's too fucking stupid to pull off that D.B. Cooper thing.
Yeah, definitely.
It would be really cool if it was him.
Wow.
I hope whoever the D.B. Cooper is, I hope that that's the only crime he committed his entire life, and I hope that he sailed off magically to wherever his special place was. I hope it wasn't John List.
I usually don't root for the bad guy, but in D.B. Cooper's case, I kind of do.
Speaking of bad guys, this John List fucking asshole.
Sure.
Probably the ultimate of all bad guys.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
Fuck him, but a clean murder, cleaned it up real good. Even the broken teeth, he cleaned it all up. He did a good job taking care of everybody.
What a fucking tool.
Even sat down, had himself a little sandwich.
Got a sandwich.
Kind of sandwich you think he made? He definitely strikes me as a corned beef guy.
Corned beef hash. I don't know. I expected some like fucking backwoods things like fucking bologna and macaroni or something.
Bologna and macaroni. That's the nastiest shit.
Bananas and ketchup.
My wife, sometimes she'll get a wild hair. She'll eat peanut butter, banana, and mayonnaise sandwiches.
See, peanut butter and banana I fucks with, but yeah. Mayonnaise I can't do. Nah.
Listen, I don't know if I told you about this, but I started doing this a few weeks ago. When you're making a grilled cheese,
okay,
use mayonnaise instead of butter.
Okay, I've heard of that.
Yeah. Oh my God, it transcends everything you've ever had in your entire life. Okay. It's incredible. You got to try it. It's worth one shot, Rob.
Okay, sure.
So what do you think of the John List family murders?
Fuck him. I'm glad he's dead.
Hopefully Patricia got all the marijuana she wanted.
And if there was a heaven, I hope his kids booted him.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Brohio Podcast. As always, I'm one half of the amazing gay duo with the cream spot, a.k.a. Delicious Nickalicious.
And I am the left nut of the nutsack. I am Rob Dog.
And this guy over here on the right
is nice Bill Wilkins, and he's 73 years old, and he died in his own shit.
Thanks for joining us on this special episode.
Thank you very much. We love you guys very much.
We're going to break all the records in the entire world of podcasting with this episode.
We're going to make love to every one of you.
Tell them the good.
I fucking love you.